Hello and welcome to Didn't I Blow Your Mind This Time, the podcast where my co-host and I take turns trying to blow each other's minds with our movie picks. There's no other podcast like it.
If there is, I dare them to be better than us.
Yeah, I mean, there probably are a few like it. Let's be honest.
People are not talking about these. We are on the cutting edge. So far this season, in season two, we talked about Wild at Heart. And what I didn't bring up last time was that it is not available on streaming. It is pretty difficult to get a hold of. I had to get a hard copy DVD of Wild at Heart to watch, which, you know, these days that might as well put it in Fort Knox.
I went to my local library. I also got a DVD.
And so for this one, you were able to find it on streaming on something called, what is it? Cinemax?
Cinemax. You know it as Skinemax.
I do. And it looks like just from a brief perusal, they're still holding up, maintaining the brand.
I get a free trial on Cinemax for the week through my Amazon.
I have to talk about 1991's Ricochet, which I watched on DVD. I happen to own it. But I tell you what, I haven't seen it since 1991.
Let the backtracking begin.
Okay, let's just dive right in here. This is a movie that was originally it's a story by Fred Decker. I think he had a screenplay and he pitched it as a Dirty Harry movie. Clint thought it was too grisly, even for him to be a Dirty Harry movie. And so Fred Decker shopped it around and eventually almost got Kurt Russell as the as our man Styles, and Rutger Hauer was going to be the bad guy. That would have been good. That did not work out. Somehow it became a Joel Silver picture. And Joel Silver hired Stephen D'Souza, who I will talk a little bit more about, to write another draft of this movie, which places it in a not largely recognized universe, which is the Valverde universe. And I will talk more about that in a second. But let's get to the director, Russell Mulcahy. Do you know anything about him, Duncan?
I've got to confess, I really do not know his body of work.
So I know about him from another podcast that I do, The Well of Sound.
Oh, boy. Somebody loves to bring up their other podcast. How does he do it all? How does he find the time?
The reason why I know about him is we did an episode on Meatloaf and Jim Steinman. And Jim Steinman is responsible for Total Eclipse of the Heart, which Bonnie Tyler recorded, and Russell Mulcahy directed the video. He is also responsible for some other big MTV videos of the era, including Video Killed the Radio Star, Betty Davis Eyes, Hungry Like the Wolf, Allentown, Pressure, and many, many more. I know those are hits of yours. Just the two Joel shout outs, right?
I mean, you're going through my karaoke hit list right now.
He also directed three features before Ricochet. The first is one that I have not seen and want to see. It's called Razorback. Russell Mulcahy is Australian. Razorback is an Australian movie written by Everett DeRoche, who wrote The Long Weekend, Patrick, and Road Games, all of which are cult classics, right? His second movie was Highlander with Sean Connery. And third, Highlander 2, which came out the same year as Ricochet. So really, 1991 was a big year for Mulcahy.
Quite a pedigree.
Yeah.
And can I ask you, who did you see this movie with? I'm assuming you saw this in the theater.
I actually did not. I saw it on home video with my friend. If I'm remembering correctly, it was with my friend Martin Wright. I remember being blown away by it. I'm going to clear the air right now.
Okay. Okay.
And I'm going to say that this viewing, I was a little disappointed, but I think it'll still be a fun movie to talk about.
All right. Well, someone is, wow, coming out of the gate, the opposite of hot, ice cold, backpedaling already. I don't think I've seen you backpedal with a pick like this ever. Well, I've got to say my emotions were ricocheting around all over the place as I was watching this, so I'm not going to really tell you where I land. I have to say I was very surprised I hadn't seen this film. There were a lot of surprises, but there were also a few moments that felt very familiar to the point where I chimed in on my high school text chain and asked my boys if anybody remembered seeing Ricochet with me at the Town Center Mall in Boca back in the day. Nobody knew what the hell I was talking about. They all have lives and they're like, what? You're doing a podcast? What is this movie? I think maybe I had a little bit of awareness of John Lithgow's character. But yeah, let's get into it. This movie kicks off with some real big score Hitchcock theme and a flashy credit sequence that feels very Hitchcocky by way of De Palma and the fact that Lithgow's in it too. I was getting comfy on my sofa, getting pretty excited.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that makes sense that you feel like you could have watched this because there's a lot of elements in this movie that just feel like everything was circling around at the time. I mean, there was tons of Hitchcockian thrillers about to kick off if they hadn't already. Ice-T did New Jack City that year, so Ice-T in movies was a thing that was about to take over. This is the first sort of crazy villain that John Lithgow played before Raising Kane and then Cliffhanger.
Well, now hold on, my friend. Uh-oh. I think he might have played a couple of villains before in some De Palma movies. I mean, not as over
fair.
The top, but
that's
you know, he's
fair. No, this he's is got scenery the,
I guess that would be he was, you know, kind of that the real ice cold assassin in Blow Up.
Yeah.
Or is it Blow Out? I always mix them up. And then
Blow Out.
I watched Obsession recently and was surprised by how much I loved that movie with Cliff Robertson
really, you like that? I haven't seen it.
I really liked it. It's De Palma and Schrader. This is the script credit, so you know it's going to be fairly dark.
Yeah,
and it's a kind of a riff on Vertigo. Anyway, Lithgow in it plays this guy, this Southerner who is almost feels like a contemporary of Cliff Robertson, who's so much older. And you're like, wow, Lithgow, he's so much younger, but he somehow is able to step into these shoes as kind of this guy going toe to toe with this older actor. He was very good in that too. And he's fairly good as a mustache twirling scene stealer. So
there also is just the element of the innocent man getting publicly destroyed, having his life turned inside out. That feels very 90s. And in fact, this came out 5 months before Cape Fear.
Right. And when I was watching it, I was chuckling to myself because we talked about Cape Fear last season, and your arm had to be twisted to give it our equivalent of a thumbs up, which is a mind blow. And I was like, wow. And so here Lex is,
and you were
recommending
thinking, what is holding him back? Oh, it must have been his memory of Ricochet that just is held so high that nothing could compare.
Which is the greasy hot dog version of Cape Fear, which is the prime rib version of this plot. Yeah, there's a lot of things that are familiar, but there are also a lot of things in this movie that really color outside the lines and had me sitting up in my Ooh. Chair. And we can talk about those. So,
And I guess just before we totally dive in, I was in my memory, this felt like an early Denzel movie, but really Malcolm X is 92, a year later. Mo Better Blues was 1990, a year before. So he's kind of on a hot streak at this point. But then again, Heart Condition was also 1990. So, you know, that's the beginnings of Denzel, too. Do you remember Heart Condition?
I don't know Heart Condition.
What?
Look at the blankness on my face. No, I don't even remember the name. I don't know that title at all.
Bob Hoskins is a crusty American cop who has a heart attack, not just a crusty cop. He is a racist cop, and he has a heart attack, and his heart, he gets a heart transplant from a black man, played by Denzel Washington, who haunts him through the rest of the movie. It is a buddy cop movie.
He's given Jack his heart.
It's weird. I know. It's very weird.
As long as that heart's beating, we're attached.
Aren't you going to talk to me?
Racial prejudice I can understand, but ghost prejudice.
You got to help me find who killed me.
Go to hell.
That's what I'm trying to avoid.
Now, if he could just give him some soul.
Mm-hmm. I like that. Get down, brother. Give me five.
They say the heart's not the only new equipment you got.
Bob Hoskins.
Okay, if I take this stuff off.
Denzel Washington.
You stayed in the living room.
Of course. You think I could learn anything watching a white boy?
Together.
Move!
They might just make the world's first. Cardiac arrest.
This is too easy.
Heart condition.
You just got me thrown off the force and on my way to a mental institution.
Nobody's perfect.
Wow. And why aren't we watching that?
I don't remember it as quite as good. I remember maybe that it doesn't age well, but speaking of not aging well, there is some misogynistic stuff in this one right off the bat. I mean, it just sort of is throughout, which made it, for me, a tougher than usual watch. So there's this scene where Denzel has his confrontation with Lithgow at the carnival, and for the plot, he needs to strip down to his boxers, and he keeps, and there's a line that they keep replaying in the news clips after that is something like,
I laid a gun down, you let the girl go, I'll be your hostage, all right?
Drop the gun!
All right, nice and easy, I'm putting the gun down. Nice and easy. Nice and easy. Nobody gets hurt. Now, the only weapon I got left now is useless unless you're a pretty girl.
Well, am I doing a podcast with a zillennial? I barely even clocked that. But yes, we can definitely go through and make a meal out of all the very off-color moments in this movie. I sometimes find that a little reductive, but let's just get into that scene. Denzel is man, he is cut. Denzel looks great in this movie.
He worked out a lot for the role.
This is an actor that the camera loves, one of our America's greatest movie stars, and the camera's just never been more in love with him than in this movie, especially in the first half, where he is a golden boy cop who goes on this kind of has this great career. Who then becomes the DA. At one point, he picks up a woman who later becomes his wife, and he's talking about how he might be president someday. The first black president, if Jesse Jackson doesn't beat him to it.
That's right.
You can feel like the movie could almost go there with this character. He's just magical and a real charmer.
And the only thing that could make him look even better is having Kevin Pollak as a partner.
I was going to say, in a movie that is riddled with kind of these big implausibilities, the fact that Denzel and Kevin Pollak would be buddies and playing basketball for 1 second is so outrageous. I don't care. They're partners. They're police partners. Yeah. But I don't care. There is no world where these two are getting along. And Kevin Pollak's a lot of fun in this. I mean,
he is a dead man.
I literally have the word crowbarred in. Yes, his impressions, everything from kind of a lukewarm Dr. Spock to a milk toast Columbo.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Excuse me, ma'am. Jeez, I'm sorry. Can I bring you baked potato with fish? What the hell was I thinking?
And my favorite part about those impressions is just how over it the Denzel character. He gives him a light chuckle, but he really does not feel like he's enjoying Kevin Pollak's antics.
No, because he has his own. I mean, there's a lot of ham-fisted lines throughout this, and partially I kind of want to assume that it is a nod to the hard-boiled noir type thriller that it's trying to be. When Denzel, I mean, but also it's written by Steven D'Souza, so it has 80s action hero lines in it, but because it's the 90s, it's they're over the top. So when Denzel takes out John Lithgow's character at the beginning in the event that sets off the whole movie afterwards. The reason why he stripped down to his underwear and said, yeah, I don't have a gun.
Set the table a little bit, because I think a lot of people haven't seen the movie and a lot of people aren't going to watch the movie the way we're describing
based on
it.
My so review.
Just set the table for this pivotal scene.
Okay, so Kevin Pollak and Denzel Washington are walking the beat. They're at a carnival. And meanwhile, at a building kind of above the carnival, John Lithgow. And this isn't made clear until later, but essentially John Lithgow is a up-and-coming hitman who hopes that this job that he's about to take on is going to make him very well-known and kind of push him into the next level of being a hitman, I guess, right? That's the premise.
And Lex, I just want to pause here for a second. How do you know John Lithgow is a bad guy in this movie? Because one thing that speaks to...
He treats his lackey like shit.
I didn't even have that one. Treats his lackey like shit. And let's get back to that lackey, because this might be one of the worst lackeys in all of movie history.
Thank
I didn't know if this was
that.
Someone's cousin or something. He kept showing up in the movie, and I was like, who is this guy? Lithgow is this total
horrible.
Bad boy. And there's this actor who I hate to call out performances that are not great. I don't like to do that, but it just seems miscast. He looks like a prep school kid. I didn't even know what he
was
doing.
It looks
like
he's been in plenty of movies and has had a full career. So we're not shitting on him too much.
It just seems like maybe a bit of miscasting. But just to talk about how over the top this movie is in so many ways, the Lithgow character, you know, he's a bad guy for many reasons, treats his lackey badly. He has three names.
Oh, yeah.
Earl Talbot Blake. He's got a kind of a very intense spiky hairpiece.
Yes.
He has a milky eye, and he also has a creepy earring.
He has a cross, crucifix earring that dangles and is silver. I gotta say.
And Denzel's also wearing
great.
A crucifix. He looks fantastic.
He looks fantastic.
Lithgow's fantastic. And one thing I liked about this movie is that you're right. Denzel was red hot doing a lot of great prestige projects. And Lithgow was at the height of his powers, multiple Academy Award nominations. He's all over the place. He's doing fantastic. And it's like they both decided just to take a time out and sit down, put on the bibs, and eat a big, fat, greasy cheeseburger with this movie.
And that's exactly right. And you know you're in for it when his hit goes wrong. Lithgow flies out of a window and Denzel is on top of him, ready to take him down. And Lithgow takes a hostage. So he has a shotgun pointed at this poor girl who's in his arms. And so Denzel proceeds to pull the hero monologue and say, "Let the girl go, just take me." And in the course of doing so, inexplicably, he takes off all his clothes until he's down to his boxers.
To show he's not packing any weapons.
Well, he makes it very clear because he keeps saying it. And then, you know.
And the bod is looking next
good.
Level.
Looking fantastic. And he's, he's delivering acting-wise.
Luckily for America, some fat slob in the crowd has his video camera and is filming this so that the whole world can see this moment.
And so what he does is he pulls kind of it's basically like a gunslinger move where he has hidden in the back of his boxers a little Beretta, and he shoots Lithgow with it in kind of a twist move, and it's very impressive. Takes Lithgow out, and then when everything is settled, they've got Lithgow in cuffs. Denzel says, this is what I was finally building to, says,
"Yeah, I guess a Beretta in the butt beats a butterfly in the boot, huh?"
Which means that Lithgow was coming at him with a butterfly knife. So that's what we're in for. That's the kind of ham-fisted dialogue that is scene to scene in this puppy.
And not everyone can deliver a line like that. In fact, few actors can. And Denzel sells it.
Oh, kick it on.
I want to highlight another line in this scene. During the standoff, Lithgow has grabbed a woman from the crowd and has a shotgun pressed to the tip of her chin. So he's clearly about to blow her head off.
Yeah,
and he says something to the effect of,
"Ford, back off, or else she's going to need a paper bag overhead when her boyfriend fucks what's left of her. Come on, drop it."
Kind of a nasty line, but also clearly if he fires the shotgun, she's going to be dead. It's not like he's blowing her face off.
Yeah,
so you're not, it doesn't make any sense unless Lithgow is thinking her boyfriend's going to be banging her dead body.
Right.
It's so bizarre. And later in prison, when he's stewing over this pivotal moment where Denzel's life goes one way and his life goes the other way, the line echoes again through his mind. So it wasn't just some on-the-day riff that Lithgow came up with for his character.
No, there's a lot of because there is such a VHS element to the movie, there are clips that are replayed often, and they really drill down on a lot of key lines. And this is where I wanted to talk about the news reporter, Gail Wallen, played by Mary Ellen Trainer, who you would recognize from Lethal Weapon, and also...
That's right, the therapist from Lethal Weapon.
Right.
She's always giving cops a hard time.
This
pretty woman.
Now, her character, Gail Wallens, also shows up in Die Hard, the same character, which ties Ricochet to Die Hard in this grander universe, and Die Hard... In Die Hard 2, there's mention of a country that Franco Nero is from. He's the dictator in Die Hard 2. He's the dictator of a country called Valverde, which is also a country mentioned in Commando, Predator, and even it's even tied to Speed. So, and then Predator, because of Predator versus Alien, or Alien versus Predator, is tied into the Valverde universe. So all of this, people, this is a big internet, it's not a conspiracy, but it's the talk of many an 80s action nerd about the grand the grandness of the Valverde universe, which is basically overseen by Joel Silver and Steven D'Souza. And Ricochet is part of that. And
I am loving this. And that's not me coughing in boredom. That's my dog with his bronchitis. So I am loving these fun facts. I had no idea. Ring a bell with me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She plays a much bigger part in this movie than in Die Hard. But she is in Die Hard. And that's how Ricochet gets tied in to that larger Fox-based universe.
I'm gonna be digging in. I'm gonna be nerding out on that.
It's good tonight. Stuff. It's good stuff. So, speaking of recycled video, so Lithgow is in prison, and 2 years pass, and we know that because we see sort of a cops style show called Busted, where we see Denzel and Kevin Pollak undercover, and we get some narration on that video and understand that basically Denzel has become a star cop since busting Lithgow's character, Earl Talbot Blake, and he is basically in his final days of being a cop. He's about to be an assistant DA. And one of my favorite little things about that busted video clip is that the voiceover, the transition is Ernie Anderson, P.T. Anderson's dad, saying, busted, followed tonight by Love Boat.
Oh, I love it. I love it.
And then, so we cut back to Lithgow's character, who beats the shit out of his cellmate, played by Jesse Ventura.
The governor.
The governor, with a tattoo on his head.
Which is a great scene and a great moment. Not only does he beat the shit out of him, but then he takes pains to kind of clear all his books off the bookshelf and replace them with his books, his books and tracts. And then he takes down a kind of muscle poster that Jesse has of himself, and puts up the newspaper clipping of Denzel being promoted, so he can to better focus and obsess on his arch enemy.
Right, and this begins the psychotic collage of cutouts and newspaper clippings and magazine covers of Denzel that he creates all over his cell to really send it home that he's thinking of nothing else but Denzel Washington's character.
Nothing but Denzel. Nothing but Denzel.
I mean, can you blame him?
I really can't. We should probably say, not to objectify Denzel too much, but let's not forget that after this scene where Denzel does a strip down with Lithgow, and it's recorded and blasted out over America and launches Denzel's career, I believe the next scene he's in is him in the locker room at the police station, butt naked, covering his junk with a locker.
Oh, don't put your uniform back on. You took it off for the psychopath. Keep it off for me. I don't want you wearing anything from this point on, except civvies. You and your partner have both been promoted to detective by Chief Floyd. Congratulations.
And so they're really getting a lot of mileage out of Denzel's
They really
bot.
Are.
For every misogynistic trope, we also, I don't know, I guess we have a little trade-off with a little Denzel ogling.
Well, that's true, and it will reach its absolute heights later in the movie. But we'll get to that. So there's another insane line as John Lithgow's character is being pulled into. Oh well, we don't want to skip the bizarre battle that happens in a cafeteria between Lithgow and Jesse Ventura, where they tape phone books onto themselves and basically look like road warriors. So the Australia is coming out in Mulcahy's direction as we see this wild battle in the cafeteria, which is pretty cool to look at.
It's a pretty wild scene. There's that. There's another wild scene where Lithgow is recuperating in the prison hospital, and
with the little bookman.
The bookman comes by giving out books to prisoners, and of course Lithgow is character Earl Talbot Blake. It doesn't seem like a big reader, and he doesn't want any books. But then he does take a couple books. He takes the Bible and War and Peace.
The bookman
hands him the most comically enormous War and Peace prop that you've ever seen, and you don't know.
How many times has War and Peace been referenced in pop culture? It just feels like, that's all they ever talk about is the longest book of all time.
Well, this is a highly literate movie, because don't forget when Denzel meets his future wife in the basketball game that opens the film, she is studying Moby Dick, which of course Denzel has read and wrote a paper on and is more than happy.
He wrote a thesis on for law school. I wrote that down. I was like, why did he write a thesis about Moby Dick for law school?
And now that we're revisiting
maritime
this moment,
law.
I'm going to do the thing that I just dragged you for doing in terms of looking at this through a now lens, and say that Denzel's pickup of his future wife is so incredibly creepy.
That's what I was talking about. That's why I was like, oh, they are not doing a good job with setting up this heroic character. He just sounds like a dickhead.
He writes her a ticket and then says,
now, if you'd like to get this fixed, I'm available for begging and pleading Saturday at 8 o'clock.
Hey, it was just the way things were done. Speaking of creepy pickup lines, I rewatched Marathon Man the other night.
Oh.
Dustin Hoffman, who you are supposed to be somewhat sympathetic, in, especially in the first act, he hides this woman's library book, then follows her home to return the library book that he basically stole. Then she doesn't invite him up, and he still manages to weasel his way in the building when she thought she closed the door behind him, go up the steps, almost force his way into the apartment before he gets a dinner invitation from her or gets her to consent to a dinner invitation. Of course, she finds the whole thing pretty charming.
With these guys as our heroes, how did we even make it out of the 90s?
Yeah, I don't know. But Denzel sells it a lot more. If you're going to be a creep, Denzel can sell it a lot more than Dustin Hoffman.
That's true.
Anyway, just to get back to the, Lithgow gets these two bizarrely enormous books from the bookman, rips off the bandages on his bullet-ridden knee, and slaps the books over his foot to make some kind of like prosthetic. I wasn't even sure what was going on, and is able to then hobble out of the hospital.
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't really follow that part, but eventually we get to what proves to be his parole hearing, which will also prove to be part of his escape plan. But I just want to mention what the prison guard says to him, back to insane lines. The prison guard says, you know, get ready. I hope you remembered to floss. And Lithgow says, I did, with your wife's pubic hair. Like, this is what we're dealing with here. But
this film got mostly good reviews that I could find at the time.
Not by Roger Ebert.
There were
embarrassing.
Oh, hold it. No. I think Roger gave a thumbs up, though.
No, Gene gave it a havesy-havesy. And okay. Ebert...
A havesy-havesy. The thumb's either up or down, my friend.
They didn't bother. They just rushed into their review of Shattered with Tom Berenger and Greta Scacchi and Bob Hoskins.
Okay, I'm going to have to check my notes, but mostly good reviews, but there were some reviews, yes, that called this a very sick movie. It is over the top. It's over the top in every way.
And this parole escape is the first truly insane
shockingly violence.
Yeah. Which, it doesn't make sense that there's construction happening next to where the parole board is seeing prisoners. But
you don't think it makes sense? There's a buzzsaw just lying around the parole hearing room?
They're basically, everybody in the room is killed with some sort of like there's a zip gun, there is a table saw or a buzz saw and a drill, and it is gnarly. But they get out of there and they're on their way.
And if we're tracking the kind of the nastiest, most egregious lines in this film, I really enjoyed the moment where the parole board asks Lithgow about his, you know, where he is in terms of his mental state and right. contributions to society if he were to be paroled. And Lithgow comments,
well, I guess, Mr. Chairman, that first I'd pay a visit to your house.
To thank me, I suppose.
No. To fuck your wife and your daughter. Hell, maybe even your dog.
Which speaks to Lithgow's kind of perverse sexuality in this role and the line I said before about him blowing the woman's head off and the boyfriend.
Yeah.
You don't know what's going on with Lithgow in this movie. You don't know what, all you know is he's obsessed with Denzel.
That's it.
There might be a flavor of homoeroticism there? I'm not sure.
Oh, there definitely is. Okay. Because eventually we are going to get to
Lex has the homoeroticism meter out and says that definitely is. Okay. I was just theorizing. I'm glad that was confirmed.
We will eventually get to our, what Joel Silver calls our fall in hate scene. And fallen hate is what Joel Silver likes to put in every one of his pictures, where the enemy, where the good guy and the bad guy come face to face. That's what he coins that this type of scene, the fallen hate scene, where they're face to face and they truly get to appreciate one another as foes. But in the case of Lithgow and Denzel, it's over an arm wrestling scene. And Lithgow does this big build up of how, you know, Denzel's career couldn't have happened if it weren't for meeting him. He is responsible for his career, and, you know, they're basically diametrically opposed, forces of nature. And it all builds to this moment of Lithgow saying, but this, you know, as important as we are to one another, this is the first time we've touched. So there's your loaded.
And Joel Silver calls this a what? A fallen?
Fall in hate, as opposed fall to in fall hate. In
oh,
love.
Oh, fall in love.
Scene.
Okay. I read a quote by him where he called this an anti-buddy movie, and I liked that a lot.
Which it is. I skipped over a bunch of stuff to get to that arm wrestling scene. So, I don't know if you want to cover anything. There is, I wrote down this line, which is when Denzel, so basically John Lithgow gets out of prison and makes quick business of getting his revenge plot in action. And we don't, you know, theoretically, we don't quite know what he's doing or how he's pulling it together, but it's all going to be a build up to abducting Denzel. And he does a couple things along the way. But when they finally get Denzel, I'm skipping over the part where his buddy is killed.
Have you seen this movie?
I just realized I didn't have notes on this part because I just.
You mean the escape sequence,
the fundraiser, and the fundraiser and the videotaping of the kids. So
right,
let's all of that. I don't.
Let
know if you
me
want to take that down.
Take a backtrack.
Okay, do it.
First and say, I don't want to miss just briefly clocking this scene because it speaks to my feelings of the movie. And I feel like it might almost be the weakest scene in the movie. There is a subplot about Denzel and Ice-T's relationship. Ice-T was his basketball buddy on the streets. But Ice-T, you may have guessed, is a little bit of a bad seed. Mm-hmm. He's gone from carjacking to now he has this probably the same set from New Jack City set up where he is supplying people with cocaine and crack. And Denzel doesn't like this. And we've got this scene where Denzel goes into the crack house. He grabs some pipe out of a junkie's hand and just tosses it aside. And he goes up to Ice-T. And in front of all Ice-T's lackeys, demands that Ice-T make a neutral zone of the LA Towers where Denzel is launching a fundraiser to, I believe, rebuild the towers. He doesn't want Ice-T's character Odessa dealing drugs there.
Yeah, I think he's going to make a community center at what essentially are Watts Towers. But
yes, although they never use the word Watts Towers in the movie. They call them the L.A. Towers.
Yeah.
Right. Ice-T, of course, pushes back. He doesn't play that way.
Mm-hmm,
and Denzel removes a grenade from his jacket pocket. And he tells Ice and his posse that he's willing to die for this. And are they willing to die for it? And he pulls the pin of the grenade.
Uh-huh.
And everyone, breathes deep. as Denzel, you know, goes crazy, and Ice-T backs down, and he's going to make this a neutral zone. And you cut to Denzel going outside, and I believe it's talking with Kevin Pollak. And lo and behold, the grenade is just a lighter.
I was pissed off.
Fairly weak in every sense of the word. For one reason, I don't think anybody watching this movie, no matter how old you are, you could be 5 years old, I don't think anybody believed Denzel had a grenade. And I didn't understand. He pulls the pin in the grenade, but then he doesn't pull the pin back in. There's like, he pulls the pin.
You mean when it's revealed that it's a lighter? I think because
with Ice-T, he pulls the pin. Like, I'm going to blow this whole place up. He pulls the pin. Everyone's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. And then nothing happens. Then he doesn't do anything. We kind of cut to him outside. What am I missing? Do I not know how grenades work?
That's correct.
Okay.
You pull a pin, but you hold, it has a handle which you squeeze.
Yeah.
And the reason why you can pull the pin is because you've squeezed the handle and it easily comes out, right? It's pressure. It's the pin is in there by pressure. So when you squeeze it, you have the freedom to pull out the pin. Once you pull out the pin, and if you let go of that handle, the grenade is going to blow in whatever, 5 seconds, enough time to throw it. Does that make sense?
Right, so I guess I don't know how grenades work. Either way, the scene stinks. There is no way anyone believed this was a grenade. It was so ridiculous.
Well, yeah, it was a
and
lot.
And I know I'm
a bunch of people that
a movie
don't
that's
know
is, but it also, it felt like, yeah, it was, that to me was just like, I was getting a little worried. I was like, okay, this movie is getting into like, yeah, shitty territory. I'll just call it shitty territory.
Yeah, and then we get into this fundraiser, which kind of takes up too much time of the movie. John Amos is Denzel's dad, who's a preacher, and they have this fundraiser where Lithgow sends in enough cash for them to go over the top. Why he does that, it doesn't really matter, but he does it all. In the meantime, while Denzel and the wife are away at the fundraiser, he sneaks into Denzel's house when the babysitter's there and just tells the kids a story. He's there under the guise of being the power man because the power went out. And he uses the opportunity to videotape the kids when they're asleep, which is a setup for later. So nothing really happens until Denzel's business partner is killed by Lithgow. It's made to look like a suicide and
a kinky suicide.
Correct. And the suicide note implies that he and Denzel were molesting children, and that if they were going to open a children's center, it would be too irresistible to this guy, and you know, so he had to off himself.
And now Denzel being portrayed as the ultimate golden boy is kind of paying off a little bit, because by this point in the movie I was like, boy, I would love Denzel just to be a little flawed. I enjoy cocky Denzel as much as the next guy, but now I see what the payoff is, because now we've got a big fall from grace for Denzel as Lithgow's character starts putting chinks in his armor in a very public way. And it's playing out on a large scale media playground. So Denzel was made by the media, and now the Lithgow character is going to use the media to destroy him.
Right. Right. And so things start to step up here. Lithgow kidnaps Denzel. And here's another one of these insane lines where the lackey character we were talking about, when he's almost run over by Lithgow and the lackey, and when Denzel sees Lithgow, we should say that Lithgow faked his death after he escaped from prison. So everybody thinks that he's dead. So when Denzel sees him on the street, he says,
"Jesus Christ. Almost.
I bet he shit his pants. I can't wait to look."
Then the lackey knocks out Denzel. He falls to the ground. And the lackey says, I bet he shit his pants. I can't wait to look. Which I don't know what that says about this character. There's a lot of that kind of like overcomplicated, gruesome point of view.
Well, I like that line for this character, but you don't know anything else about this guy who looks like he escaped from prep school. So I don't know. I enjoyed that.
Right. That adds dimension.
It felt like it was ADR later on. You know, they were looking for something there. And I was like, oh, wow, who came up with this line? Who riffed this? But yeah, he wanted to check Denzel's again, wanted to get Denzel's clothes off, but this time to see if he laid a dookie. But that's the world we're in. And in some ways, I like it.
Okay, so then we get the arm wrestling scene that I mentioned, and when Denzel loses the arm wrestling match, the lackey runs in and shoots him up with heroin, and so now begins a sort of a drug sequence where they put Denzel in a bed, and they make a sex tape, basically.
They rape Denzel. A sex worker. So here we are again, in the world of assault.
Exactly. Wild at Heart had it too. I don't know what's going on. Is it just that rape is in so many movies and we just never realized it, or what is happening?
I did not realize it, and I think it might also be, and we need to examine this in a special episode. Maybe. There might be a link to what you and I view as brain-blowing movies. It seems to be in everything from Clifford. It's in every movie. And what that says about society might be something for a larger conversation than just a sidebar during Ricochet. But yes, a sex worker is brought in to have sex with Denzel while it is being videotaped, and Denzel is powerless to fight her off. And this was a moment where it was very disturbing, but yeah. I also was like, I feel like I've seen this before. Is that a trope? We're almost in like Weekend at Bernie's territory a little bit, where they're using Denzel's drugged out body to make him look bad. I know I've seen it in a comedy before. I was like, have I seen this in a cop movie before? It felt very familiar.
So I don't know, but this is one of the big things I remember about the movie. So I would remember it from this. What I guess I misremembered about this movie, and I was actually totally shocked that it didn't go this way, is what happens afterwards. So they let Denzel go. They toss him out on the street. Everybody's looking for Denzel. He's in the hospital. He's trying to explain himself. Nobody believes that it's Lithgow's character that kidnapped him, because he's been established as dead. So he's, again, after his friend died, and there's the molestation reports and all of that stuff, he's starting to be in a bad space where people are questioning him. He's kind of falling apart at the seams, as Lithgow had planned. And then he goes home and he's spiraling, he's drinking a lot. And then he gets news from Lindsay Wagner, who is the DA, that they did a blood test and found out that he had coke and heroin. And also he got the clap.
Right. Use a very scary term for the clap. It's like,
well, Wikipedia,
AIDS-y simplex gonorrhea or something, you know. I was like, oh, and then it was like, it's the clap. Oh, okay. Still not the thing you want to hear. Well, his wife is appalled.
Well, that helps me because also in the scene before, he's watching sort of a Larry King type show where there's a guest who's saying that they believe that Denzel's character is telling the truth about being kidnapped, because it's it demonstrates that there's conspiracy against black leaders, that anytime a black man is in a position of power. He is undermined by the media. And he says something about AIDS in vending machines, which I don't know that. I don't remember that from the 80s, what that was about. But that precedes the news that about the blood test. Now, that's a long way of me getting to what I thought I remembered about this movie, is that Lithgow gave Denzel's character HIV.
Okay. That would have been awesome.
So that's why I picked this movie, frankly, because that's what I remember about the movie. And I was like, holy shit, that was like the biggest move ever. And I would love to watch it again and figure out how they got out of that. Like, what did they do with that?
How they got out of AIDS?
No, like, how did they handle that for the protagonist in 1991 in an action movie with Denzel Washington and movie stars? And you know, that's a lot to put on a Hollywood cop main character. And so in my mind, that's what I remembered about, like, holy shit, they pulled a serious move in this movie. Turns out.
I love that you misremembered that, because that does sound disturbing.
Yeah.
Titillating. Yeah. Bizarre. Yeah. But yes, unfortunately for the viewer, Denzel just has an old boring case of the clap. So he's got to get a dose of penicillin. Not quite as dramatic as if he had been injected with
HIV in 1991,
which would have been extremely disturbing.
Monumental.
Probably cost this movie, which was, I believe, a mild hit. Probably would have decimated its box office numbers. But we would have maybe enjoyed it a little more.
Maybe.
I don't know where you would go with that in the movie.
I don't know either. Well, that's what I was trying. That's the detective work I was doing after. And
I wish I could have been there on the couch with you when you realized you had misremembered the movie. Meanwhile, I'm sitting there being like, have I seen this movie? So we're in the gaslighting part of the movie, which to me, gaslighting can get very old very quickly. When the protagonist is you've got scene after scene of them telling the powers that be what's really going on, and they
crazy.
Look crazier and crazier. That said, part of the fun of the movie is getting to see Denzel, who is
do his thing,
but color outside the lines a little bit, because Denzel, as our best movie stars are, you know, they go through these periods where they're doing star Denzel's almost at this point in his career where he's doing star turns. You know, he's doing great prestige movies, but he's also doing he's doing some roles where he's not always there's a great story that I believe is Ridley Scott directed American Gangster, where I think Denzel was pushing back a little bit on the scene where his character doesn't know where the money is. He's asking where the money is in some scene. And he said to Ridley Scott, my fans know that my character would know that I know where the money is.
Right.
So
there's kind of this element of
not wanting to be dumbed down in any way or vulnerable. I think sometimes stars have that. Denzel's obviously doing all types of a great spectrum of amazing work.
Of course.
That said, to see Denzel both ham it up, look like an asshole, and also be losing his shit in front of
Mean run down the street half naked in a pink robe and slippers and then tackle a clown, do you?
I do.
Scene was phenomenal. Like, he pulled a Tom Cruise running down the street in slippers that could easily have, like, bungled him. His pink robe is flying open. Once again, we're seeing Denzel in what, up to this point, people might think his signature white boxers. He thinks that Lithgow is going to attack his kid's kindergarten play, which is at an outdoor theater. And when he sees a man in a black coat and a wide brim hat approaching the stage, he tackles him, and turns out, he flips the guy over who's freaking out, and he has clown makeup, and what are you doing, pal?
But that is nothing in terms of Denzel laying himself bare and being vulnerable in comparison to the scene, maybe two scenes later, when Denzel, crazed, is in the mayor's office.
Oh,
and to vindicate himself, he slaps a videotape in the VCR, expecting to cue up a moment where Lithgow is crouched over his children with an axe, but instead ends up showing the mayor and all the suits in the office a videotape of himself in bed, drugged up. They don't know that, banging a hooker.
Right. Which has
might have
been
my favorite scene in the movie.
And then, right, he fully mentally declines in that moment, does like a big stutter fest. But I mean, it's pure Denzel. He's like, you know, he's going 100 miles an hour, fumbling through, doing the crazy eyes and the, you know, the head shake that we know to be great Denzel. And that, so that scene is actually what Ebert was talking about when he said was embarrassing.
I can't believe that you like that scene where Denzel Washington is standing on top of the building that you pointed out there is one of the better scenes in the movie. I thought it was embarrassing. And I thought there's a scene right before that where Denzel Washington is so emotionally distraught that he can't get a sentence out and he starts, you know, blathering incomplete sentence fragments. That was embarrassing too. Somebody should have had mercy on this poor actor who was asked to do this. And as for that, the basic plot, which is the innocent man who's framed, is right out of Hitchcock and could have been a good film. But the way they do it with things involving child pornography and putting children in danger and accusations of sexual perversion and fake porno tapes and so forth, it's just so unsavory and so distasteful. And perhaps in a significant film, I wouldn't object to it, but this film is as light as a feather. So why deal in this ugly stuff?
I'm a little more reluctant to buy the many times Denzel kind of hoists himself up by his own petard in terms of, let me show you the videotape that I just grabbed from the house, or let me take you to the place where I'm sure they drugged me, and let's bring the media along too, because I know that this is definitely the spot. You know, he's the characters are not playing at the top of their intelligence.
It's foolish. Yeah.
But I'll tell you what did make an impression is, yes, then we get to the scene with
the
Denzel.
Looney Tunes monologue on top of the building.
Yes. Again, Denzel balls to the wall. It's a Denzel I haven't seen before.
No,
I want to look away. It's a car crash, but I'm also loving it. Is he in the pink robe again? He's putting on lipstick.
He's putting on lipstick. Why he even thinks he needs lipstick? Nobody can see that far up. He's on the top of a building and he's doing this crazy monologue where he's saying he's going to kill himself. Essentially, he's putting on pancake makeup and lipstick. It makes no sense, but he is committed. Oh my God, is he committed? And Lithgow is watching below going, no, don't do it, because he wants Denzel to go to jail and suffer like he did. He does not want this guy to take the easy way out and commit suicide.
No, you can't. What are you doing?
Oh, let's see. I mugged Ronald McDonald. I robbed my father's church. And I run a child pornography ring, too. Yeah, I killed my best friend. This one's gonna kill you. No, it's not gonna kill you. It's gonna kill me.
You can't die. You have to live and suffer for years and years.
Denzel fakes his own death by blowing up the building and jumping down a fire chute, making it look like he was killed. Why he goes to that much effort,
I
don't know.
Just one little quibble. Did he clear it with iced tea before he blew up his crack lab that's on the top floor of the building?
That was confusing. I don't think that was the same building because he he took his family to Ice-T for protection and right. told them to stay there. So I feel like that was a different building than the one that he blew up.
But it was some kind of crack lab. They make that clear. Something was going on that top floor.
Yeah, they had a bunch of chemicals and something on the top floor.
Okay, so we're both they a little fuzzy with that.
Yeah, and it's a big set piece, but it doesn't really make that much sense why he needs to do that. All he's trying to do is lure Lithgow out. So he fakes his own death and then shows up at another location. He shows up at the towers
if you want to talk about set pieces, here we go.
Well, he quickly reveals that he's not dead. So, you know, what's the point of making Lithgow think that he's dead for like 2 seconds? But also, if they were going to do that, why even reveal to the audience that he got away? Like, it's more fun for us to believe that he killed himself too, and then we get a reveal. Anyway.
Well, if Lex had his way, Denzel would have
been totally different, injected
with AIDS, and for the last third, we would have thought he was dead. But that's not the movie that was made. So I'm enjoying this moment where we go to Watts Towers, where almost the way they shot it, I don't know. I guess
they wanted
I've been to
Watts
Towers and I don't remember like the highway being that close. I wondered if it was there was they had kind of made it look like it was a little more in the middle of the city. They've got the kind of the skylines kind of pressed up against Watts Towers in a way I didn't remember.
Yeah.
For a second, I was like, oh, is this even Watts Towers or is this something they built to look like it? But I looked it up and it is.
Oh, it is. Okay.
At least in my limited research. Yeah. And then we have almost this King Kong type set piece with Denzel and Lithgow going head-to-head battle royale up in the towers.
Slash John McClane. Like, it's really clear to me, knowing that it's Joel Silver and Stephen D'Souza, that they were trying to get a little, like, a mini Die Hard going on where he's literally wearing an undershirt just like John McClane, and he's pulling some Bugs Bunny moves of, I'm over here, and Lithgow's falling for every minute as they climb taller and taller, King Kong style, on the towers. And that's when the plan with Ice-T works out, where his guys, at just the right timing, electrocute John Lithgow on the tower. They send high voltage power up the tower just as Denzel jumps off, much like John McClane.
Doesn't kill Lithgow, and they don't even seem surprised that it doesn't kill Lithgow. It was just like to give him a little kick, a little juice.
Uh-huh. And then
keep him on his toes.
Denzel manages to pull his leg, and then he skewers himself on one of the towers, and that's when Denzel's detective Styles or assistant DA Styles says,
"You got the point now, don't you, Blake?"
And then we end the movie with this curious moment, which you might want to cover because you are so clearly plugged into the reporter and her world.
So he takes over. She's doing a live broadcast, and he basically ends the broadcast. And all we hear as it cuts to black is
news at 11. Nah.
Styles, you can't do that. We're live.
We're live, huh? Good. Gail, kiss my ass.
And then it kicks into an Ice-T rap song. And that's when I really cemented my diehard Redux theory that they wanted Styles to be an ongoing character. They thought this might have been good enough to have Ricochet too, I have a feeling.
I really liked how towards the end they kind of give it this... they end on this like media is the message moment, like, hey, just because this movie was like wall-to-wall violence and some really over the top egregious nasty dialogue, don't think wink wink that we don't get it, and hey, it's all the media anyway, and we're just all performers on a stage, like just trying to like elevate it in the last 10 seconds
literally. It was wild.
And I was like, oh, yeah, I guess the media was part of it somehow. Yeah.
All right.
And that is Ricochet, my friends. And that is Ricochet. I have two questions.
Yeah.
When was the first time that Denzel really got on your radar? Because I know you're a huge fan.
Okay. Well, truthfully, I mean, I'm sure I watched like Glory in a history classroom during school. If I had to guess, I watched, or at least a scene or two, but I don't think, it was more Matthew Broderick that I was paying attention back then.
In Glory? Oh my God.
Well, I haven't seen it since then.
Okay.
I saw Heart Condition, the movie I described earlier, and I loved it. I also watched The Mighty Quinn, right, which was 1989. I loved that. So Denzel was kind of on my radar, which is why I guess I couldn't believe that. I thought Ricochet was earlier than it was. So when it was sort of back to back with Malcolm X, I was like, oh, I guess I was living in Denzel's world pretty early on. But then the one where I was like, I love Denzel for life was Devil in a Blue Dress. That was great. The one for me.
Okay.
It's a great movie.
All right. Well, I mean, I was there with Denzel St. Elsewhere style. So let's right from the beginning. I do remember, Mighty Quinn and Roger and Gene Siskel and Ebert both popping two boners over what a movie star performance he gave us in that movie. And John Lithgow, let me ask you this. Do you think John Lithgow's in the top five greatest American actors living today? I'm just throwing it out.
He's such a strange bird that I guess I don't think of him very often. I really enjoyed him in The Old Man recently. I thought he was kind of the my favorite thing about that show.
Jeff Bridges.
I kind of think he was better than Jeff Bridges in that show.
Well, that's what I'm kind of circling around here.
I mean, well, look, we both know that we both really love Jeff Bridges, so that's tough. I don't know. There's a lot. I don't know if I could put him in the top five, but he is a great one. I feel like he was ever present in my childhood. I'm a big Harry and the Hendersons fan, as you might imagine.
He just really does it all. He never turns in.
I guess I didn't like Third Rock from the Sun, and maybe that kind of like skewed my memory of it all.
Okay, I never really watched Third Rock. I know he was supposed to be great in it. He won a lot of Emmys. He turned down the role of Fraser Crane, so maybe he was like, "Give me some of that Fraser money."
He just
feels like he's always been there. He's always there, turning in great performances, whether he's on TV or in the movies. And it's quite an actor who can play some of the most salt of the earth nice guys. Like I'm thinking of him, his two kind of back to back supporting acting performances in Terms of Endearment and World According to Garp, which were probably the first movies I saw him with, and then play these kind of over the top villains that feel completely believable within their own worlds.
And I don't think I've actually seen. I can't believe I'm saying this, but I don't think I've seen the Lithgow De Palma movies. I've seen like all the other De Palma movies, but somehow I've never seen Raising Cain.
Raising Cain's good.
I would be down to do a Lithgow revisit for sure. I did love Cliffhanger when it came out. Memorial Day weekend. That's how I remember what Memorial Day weekend is. How sad is that? I remember
it's Cliffhanger it as, weekend. What? I don't even understand what you're talking about. It's the weekend you saw Cliffhanger.
I just remember that was in the promotion that they were like this Memorial Day weekend Cliffhanger. And I was like, what's Memorial Day weekend? Oh, I guess it's just when movies like Cliffhanger come out.
Wow. Yeah. I love that. It's not like a barbecue with your kids it's Cliffhanger weekend.
Yep.
All right. Well, the rubber's going to hit the road.
Well,
am I asking you if the movie blew your mind? You're the one that picked it.
And I've said my piece. I guess what I want to say about this is that it has made me hungry to find out what else of the movies I thought highly of back in the day are stand up and maybe are better than remembered. Ricochet was a fun watch, but it did not deliver on the level that I remembered. I'm looking for, is Deep Cover as good as I remember? Is Digstown as good as I remember? Oh, is Lord. Just Cause as good as I remember?
So you're telling me this podcast is going to be us like rifling through the dregs of your childhood?
I'm not making that mistake again. I am not making that mistake again.
Well, let me ask you this, because now we're kind of in uncharted territory. Are you taking back your classification of this as a movie that blew your mind?
Well, yeah, because the big turn that I thought happened definitely does not happen.
Wow. I didn't even know we could do this, but I guess we're creating our own rules. All right. Well, I guess
what did you think?
This is a very interesting episode then, because I'm feeling a little generous, and I've got to say that there was enough over the top elements in this movie that contained two of my favorite actors hamming it up.
Yeah.
That I think it just barely squeaked by for me.
Oh.
As a movie that barely blew my mind.
Well, that's something.
And part of that, I think if I had seen it at the time in the theater, I would have poo-pooed it.
Uh-huh.
I would have poo-pooed it, but now I'm so starved for this kind of greasy cheeseburger, over-the-top, hyper-violent pop culture fun.
Yeah.
That just enough of it, just enough of it was able to be enjoyable to me that I'm giving it a brain blow. I'm not going out of my way to recommend it, but I am gonna say I had a good time with it.
I'm glad
in a nostalgic
that.
Way, but I'm let glad there that be a warning.
It the way I was going to give you, enjoy it.
I was going to give you a warning that if this is going to be the path you take for the rest of the podcast, I am not going to be so generous in the future, but here you are self-flagellating before I even have a chance to flagellate.
Well, I'll leave us on a high note, which is a scene that I forgot to mention, which was really made me laugh, was Kevin Pollak's death scene after he delivers the box of evidence that's like, guess what, buddy? You were right. I talked to a guy at the prison and he's been obsessed with you. Look at all this stuff. And he just dumps a box of like crazy, like red circled pictures of Denzel and all this stuff. And then when they kill Kevin Pollak in the alleyway, or Lithgow kills him in the alleyway, he shoots him and then tosses the gun down. And like you were saying about like, you were supposed to respect our hero, but our hero picks up the gun that was used to kill Kevin Pollak and tries to shoot Lithgow. And Lithgow's like, ha ha, you picked up the gun and now your prints are on him, and then takes off. But then the capper to that scene is when Kevin Pollak gets a joke last line. He goes, I guess you were right about his death, buddy, because how could he kill me if he was dead already? I'm like, what?
The only surprising thing about that scene was how long it took for the movie to kill off Kevin Pollak. I was like, I can't believe he's even still alive.
Well, that was a treat.
Well, we had some fun, and we'll be back next episode, and this will be my
pick.
And obviously we're going to dig into some real quality.
Well, I can't wait. I'll see you next time.
Okay. See you next time, Lex. Didn't I blow your mind?